Instantly recognizable, Hey Jude was the Beatles' hit that ranked number one on the Billboard charts in America for the longest time. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. Where did Hey Jude's themes and melodies come from? How did it reflect its tumultuous times? And what was its impact on the world? My guest this hour has written a whole book devoted just to this one iconic 1968 song. A syndicated columnist and editor of a popular culture magazine and podcast, James Campion is the author most recently of Take a Sad Song, The Emotional Currency of Hey Jude. Welcome to University of the Air, James.
Emily, thank you very much for having me, and very much thanks to your colleague, Professor Craig Werner, for being one of the wonderful voices in my book.
Yes, I enjoyed reading his comments and also of so many other musicologists and professors and people from all different kinds of disciplines. I have to say, I don't know that I've ever read a book before in almost 300 pages or so devoted exclusively to one song. But it's amazing how many layers you discovered in Hey Jude. Can I ask you a personal question? Why did you choose to write a book about Hey Jude?
Well, I've told this story before, but I think it's important. My earliest sentient memories as a kid with a song, unless it was a Disney song or something from, you know, a kid's show, is na, 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 na. And so I remember singing that when I was five in 68. And I remember singing that to help me go to sleep when I was a child. And it always stuck with me. And years later, I'd hear the song as a teenager and it would come back to me, but I didn't really realize it then. And a few of the authors that have written about the Beatles and Paul McCartney told me they had similar responses to music of theirs when they were a kid. You don't really know how it's hitting you. And then I saw Paul in my 30s at Madison Square Garden touring in the 80s. I should say in my late 20s, I guess it would have been in 89. And he played Hey Jude. And the whole building was singing it, Madison Square Garden. And I got this real chill of recognition. I'm being totally honest here. It never really left me. So my real impetus, the inspiration for this book, was to find out why. Why do songs do that for us when we're 5 or 25 or wherever we are in life? And they keep paying back that emotional response. And that's why the subtitle of the book is The Emotional Currency of Hey Jude, because for me, certainly it has had it. And I believe it's also had it for Paul, the Beatles fans, and really the world, because I believe that Hey Jude is not only my favorite and best Beatles song, but I think it's one of the greatest songs ever written.
I was struck by, you refer in your book to an appearance on the Stephen Colbert show of Paul McCartney, where Colbert plays for McCartney a clip of BTS, the enormously popular Korean pop band, being asked about a favorite Beatles song. I wonder if we can play that clip and hear that and then talk about it.
Are you ever stunned by the reach of your work? How many different cultures have embraced it? Because we had on, do you know the Korean pop band BTS?
Yeah.
Okay, they're the biggest thing on the planet right now.
So I've heard.
And when we had them on, I asked them this question, Jim. You are the first group, as I said before, to earn 3 number one albums in less than a year since the Beatles. Do you guys have favorite Beatles songs?
No.
No, no, no.
What do you think it is about your music that transcends geographic and language barriers so that those 7 guys would just jump up and start the na-na-nas?
Easy lyrics.
That's true.
That clip from 2019 suggests the worldwide appeal of Hey Jude, which is kind of, it goes back to you discovering it as a child, being able to sing it, and then people all around the world joining in on that chorus.
Yeah, thanks for playing that clip. It's so nice to hear it again. I quote it, as you know, in the book.
Yeah.
And it does make, it proves that many points. First of all, the generational point, the language barrier point. I described Paul playing it at the Kremlin and all these Russian kids singing it. And then at the White House with all these dignitaries singing it. And then at the G8 summit with millions of people all over the world singing it. And it still has that same resonance with you just singing it in your car or to help you get through a nightmare when you're 5 years old. So there is something truly genius about the personal and the universal meshing together to really make great art. And I think that proves, that clip there proves in a very funny way. And it also shows Paul's amazing ability to be humble and also to be funny, because that's that great Liverpudlian humor that comes through. And I used that clip and that comment by Paul to make the point that John Lennon, who has been rightfully lauded over the years for his lyrical acumen, saying, that's one of the greatest set of lyrics Paul ever wrote. So in an essence, they are simple, but they're really not. And of course, beyond the na-na-nas, of course.
Can you take us back to the time of composition? You know, one of the things that you do in the book is to sort of set the scene just within the Beatles' own lives at the point that Paul writes this song. Can you take us back to that moment when he's comforting John Lennon's son?
Yeah, one of the things that I found that I tried to be unique about, and I've been telling interviewers, is that I wrote in the present tense for some of the chapters, because I wanted to make it immediate. I wanted you to feel what it might feel like for a brilliant songwriter to get inspiration and then fashion it into song, compose it, and then hand it off to one of the greatest musical ensembles of the latter half of the 20th century, and then hand that off to one of the great producers, George Martin, of the latter half of the 20th century, and then watch it be recorded and become the number one song in 18, 19, 20 countries all over the world in 1968. But it all really comes to Paul being this empathetic figure that I had discovered through studying about Paul, that he got from his mom, Mary, who died when he was young. But she really imparted, I often say this to interviews, it's true, she was the paragon of womanhood. She was the main money earner in the family. She was a nurse, a great caregiver. And the kids, he and Michael, his brother, really loved her and revered her. She was extremely influential in the community. His dad, James, loved her. So it was that influence, I believe, I come to learn, that got Paul to jump in his Aston Martin on a sunny, very rare sunny, late June day in England and drive an hour out to John's mansion to comfort John's six-year-old son, Julian, the same age, by the way, that I was when the na-nas comforted me, and his wife, Cynthia, because John, as we know historically, famously, left his wife and child for Yoko, the great love of his life, and there's no question that it was, and that Cynthia and John married so young because she had been pregnant with Julian. But Paul had enough, and as Rob Sheffield from Rolling Stone said to me, and he's so right, what 26-year-old rock star on top of the world, most eligible bachelor on the planet, the cute Beatle, is getting in his car and driving an hour out of his way on a Saturday afternoon to sit and make people not feel as lonely, and then write a melody? Because Paul would write melodies on the way up to this this mansion that John lived in for years. He would drive up because, John bought this with the money that the Beatles became famous in 63, 64. So this is now 68, 4 years in. And Paul's been driving up there, writing songs with John, all the great ones, 8 days a week and Drive My Car, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. I mean, the list is long. And he gets this melody in his head. Hey, Jules, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. He just wanted to, as he says, and I quote him in my book, just make them feel okay. And as almost everybody interviewed Emily in the book said, what time isn't a good time to hear that? And that's what's so beautiful about that song and why it keeps giving to this day. But it was just to comfort his high school, his teenage friend who had, the two of them wrote some of the greatest songs ever. And here he is just being a good Uncle Paul, And then he gets one of his greatest, I believe, his greatest songs out of it.
So he's comforting Julian because the parents are getting divorced. How did it turn from Hey Jules to Hey Jude?
Well, again, in his humble way, Paul told one of his biographers, I believe Barry Miles, who wrote a brilliant book called Many Years From Now, which was a great source for me. Barry's a very good guy. You know, he just said, I always loved Oklahoma, the play, and I love the character Judd, which interestingly is also a character that is sort of smitten with a woman who wants to change his life, which is kind of, you have found her, now go and get her. I love that sort of connection. And it's just because Paul is a pro. He's the pro's pro. Nobody has written more popular songs anywhere ever than Paul McCartney, who knows his way around a melody and structure and communication through song. And he's just felt that Jude was easier on the ears, easier to sing, the alliteration of it. So it becomes Jules to Jude. And I wonder, and people have asked me this, and I didn't really put it in the book, but I kind of do wonder, maybe he thought it was a little too close to the bone for his friend, John, because John would often tell him, I don't know how you play with your dad's daughter from a second marriage, or, you know, Heather, the young child of Linda, you know, how you do that, how you play with my son, Julian. I don't know how to do that, because, of course, John didn't really have familial love when he was a kid. His father left him when he was, ironically, again, Julian's age. And his mother was sort of a free spirit who couldn't really handle him. So they farmed him off to his Aunt Mimi. John didn't really have those tools in a way. But Paul did. And to this day, Julian says, I never have a birthday pass or Christmas pass without getting a card from Uncle Paul. And most of the pictures I have as a kid is playing with Paul. So Paul knew it. He was kind of supporting his friend as he did in song by going up there and comforting this kid. But ultimately, he's a pro. So he changes to Jude because it's much cooler.
You also mentioned in the book that it could be because St. Jude was the saint of lost souls.
Yeah, the patron saint of lost causes. I love that too, right? Because I talk about it, it's 1968, and this is where Professor Werner was a big help to me. And all the things that were going on there, the assassinations and the Vietnam War and the riots and the you know, all the stuff in Paris and London and New York. And you know, it's a sense of general comfort for his generation, in a sense, Paul is writing. And I just think it's so great. No matter which way you kind of absorb the song, it does have that message. The message for Paul was really the most important thing.
In that same clip with Stephen Colbert, where he listens to the na-na-nas from the BTS, he's also asked, where does the music come from? And he talks about, Paul McCartney talks about all the music he grew up hearing and singing and playing with his family.
Yeah.
And also just how he had such a large database of melodies and things that would come into his brain. You talk about a couple of influences on the Hey Jude melody in your book. Wonder if you want to tell us about that.
Yeah, so I'm glad you're asking me about this. It hasn't come up a lot in interviews, but I thought it was a great revelation. Thanks to Professor Walter Everett, who's written some wonderful books on the Beatles over the years, one with Tim Riley, another Beatles scholar and professor at Emerson College that is also contributed to the book, discovered through John Devers, a friend of his who he went to school with and that teaches organ and leads angelical choirs, you know, down south here in the United States, a woman, Mary Nixon, one of the sopranos from his choir, discovered when they were doing something, a liturgical piece from 1907. It's a traditional one, but this specific one was written by John Nicholson, Ireland. And the Te Deum is a psalm based on, again, religious subjects. And this one is for the morning, which I love. There's a morning Te Deum and an evening one. So it's the sun's coming up. There's a brightness again. There's that theme, that thread with Hey Jude. And Paul sang in the angelical choir when he was 8 years old in 1950 in Liverpool. He has very, very vague, but I think because Paul is so tuned into music that he just subconsciously held on to this. And here he's writing this song of spiritual support. And I think now, having heard it, if you listen to it, it's so stark that the first notes is bum, ba, bum, bum, ba, ba. But what Paul does is he takes the melody up because he's a pop master. He takes it from take a sad song and make it better. And so he does something pretty with it. But if you listen to the Te Deum, it's there. And it's really amazing how he takes that footprint and he makes this great song.
Let's hear the Te Deum by John Ireland from 1907 and then what Paul does with it in Hey Jude. And now let's hear Hey Jude in the opening.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better.
That is really striking. I had no idea that there was sort of a hymn underlying this song. You refer to Hey Jude at one point in your book as a secular gospel song.
Yeah, there's no question now, having spent, you know, you asked earlier, why Hey Jude, to dive into one song, and how many, and you did point out quite rightly that there are many levels, and this is one of them. And it's a true, real level. I don't think I'm really grasping at straws here, because many musicologists in the book, obviously, you know, Walter Everett and Tim Riley, Dr. Koch from NC State University, they all broke it down and said, yeah, there is a footprint for sure there. But Paul takes it and moves off of it quickly, but uses it for that clutch of the listener, especially his voice coming out of the ether like that with no effect, just his voice. And it really is a secular gospel, Emily, because he uses the amen or the plagal cadence at the end for the na-nas. And there are gospel phrasings going on in the song, which Paul adored, all the Beatles did. They loved American music, Southern American music. And the fact that he is trying to get a spiritual message across here. And it is very, very deeply spiritual, and in some ways even religious. And he's using these touch points, these touchstones in a way, to get his point across. So, you know, I keep bringing it back to, it's a very serious song for Paul. It's a very, very serious message. When he uses song, take a sad song, instead of take a divorce or take a sadness or take a... No. He uses the word song because song means the world to Paul McCartney. And he's using songs in the subtext of the music to get his point across. So yeah, those layers are absolutely there. And then at the end, when he's doing his famous screaming and Judy, Judy, and just doing his whole thing, it reminds me of the Soul Stirrers from the 50s, where Sam Cooke started, where they would do 9-10 minute. Of course, you know, Hey Jude, the longest running number one song of all time, until recently Taylor Swift beat it. But, you know, this long, drawn out, like you're feeling the spirit, feeling it and testifying. That's what he's doing. I totally believe that now, after spending this much time with the song.
More on Hey Jude when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. In music, there's a lot of magic in what we do. There's a lot of mystery. There's stuff you just can't explain. That's Paul McCartney talking about his music. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with James Campion, and we are talking about his book, Take a Sad Song, The Emotional Currency of Hey Jude. James, we were talking about the link between the melody of Hey Jude and a hymn that Paul probably sang when he was a boy. You also talk in your book about other influences on the sound of the song, including how it affects the bridge. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, and I should mention that many of the, especially Professor Devers, who teaches that type of music, was saying that the Te Deum would be a perfect thing you would sing if you were a boy. That for a boy's choir, it's perfect. It's easy to grasp. A lot of the kids would sing it. It's angelical. So he almost believes to... like 90% that, I forget what his percentage was in the book, that Paul would have at some point sung this. And in the case of this song, Save the Last Dance for Me by the Drifters, a song that Paul adored, the Beatles adored, they adored this type of music. Even though this song came out in 1960, when the Beatles were already professionally playing in places like Hamburg and in Liverpool, it was a big hit and they knew of it. And it reflects a lot. You know, Paul's first song, record that he bought when he was a kid was Come Go With Me, the Del Vikings, which work in the same period as the Drifters. But it was, again, Professor Everett that pointed out to me that, there is an imprint, there is an echo, a footnote, if you will, to when Paul goes to that wonderful bridge. It's just a absolutely stunningly beautiful bridge, and every songwriter said how much they love "Let It Out and Let It In." Hey Jude, all the different things he's doing there with the descending bass notes with the left hand, and the fluttering melody that Paul puts in there, there's just a hint of the great Ben E. King's phrasing on that song that gets you back away from the solemn, hey, everything's going to be fine, to just a fun-loving, you know, and that song, even the theme of that song where, hey, listen, I know you're going to be out having a good time with everybody. Just make sure that at the end of the night, it's you and me. And in a way, that's what Paul is saying to Julian in the world. You know, I know a lot of things are going crazy right now, but don't worry. I'm Paul. Remember, I'm the guy who wanted to hold your hand. It's going to be okay. And I, and again, it might just be me so steeped in this song. I'm getting, you know, so deep in it, but I don't think so. And many of the professors did say this was an influence and show. And there's a not so much the way George did with My Sweet Lord and He's So Fine, which became a court case, but just enough to give Paul that structure to help build his, if you want to use a house as a metaphor, to build it, to hold the framework of this bridge up. It's just great work.
Let's hear a little of Save the Last Dance and then the bridge from Hey Jude.
But don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, save the last dance for me. And anytime you feel the pain, hey Jude, refrain. Don't carry the world upon your shoulders.
It's funny to me to hear all this in the song, where it's a song I've heard, I've played it on the piano, sung along. But sometimes I think with a song, we just kind of sing along mindlessly without considering all the different influences, all the double meanings of the words, the context. And one thing your book did for me is to make it clear to me that I'll never hear this song the same way again, in a good way, in a good way.
That's my favorite. That is my favorite. Thank you. I told you when you told me that, I said, please make that a review, because that fills my heart with such joy. It's why we write. I tell all students that I speak to and everything, I write to be written. I want the audience to feel something, to get something out of it. You're spending all this time with something, so you're really passionate about it, and you want to share that passion, which, again, I hate to keep bringing it back, but it's so obvious. That's what Paul does with song. He shares that passion. And, yeah, you're supposed to sing blissfully without knowing. Who needs to know all this stuff? You don't. You know, you just sing a lot. That's the way Paul wants it, and I'm good with that, too.
Well, I'm always so grateful if someone helps me see more in a painting or hear more in a song, because it does enhance the experience. Sometimes maybe we don't want to hear something because we can't unhear it. And there's the famous account of an expletive that shows up on the recording. Do you want to, in ways that don't have to be censored, talk about that?
Yeah, well, it's just a fun little thing that I had discovered years ago, and I dug deeply in it because I knew that was a little bauble, a little sort of sidelight to the song. In the last run-through, when John and Paul are singing a great harmony together on Letter Under Your Skin, now Paul changes it from heart to skin a couple times in the song. And the way the story goes, there's many theories, but I'm willing to go with this one. John was singing Letter Into Your Heart and made a mistake. Now, they fix it later, so you don't hear the mistake, but he curses. Oh, you know. And it's there, and it's clear. What I didn't understand was why they left it in. I mean, it must happen a billion times in every song. Sinatra, Streisand, doesn't matter. And but they did, because John, wink, wink, went to engineer Jeff Emmerich and said, come on, let's leave it in. And he was even more impish because he blamed Paul for it. And I've heard it isolated, and I'm starting to think it might be Paul. But I settled on the fact that John was trying to sing the harmony, blew the word heart to skin, and then cursed. And it's as clear as, once you hear it, it is there forever. And it's so funny to think one of the most popular songs ever written has the F word in it.
Yeah, the F and hell phrase in there, which in some ways, that's what the world was around
right.
them. You know, while they're writing this pep talk, this soothing song about how everything's going to be better, all around them is chaos and tumult and hell.
Yeah, and I also think it's so great that the B-side of this song is Revolution, which is the yin to the yang that Paul and John gave us in spades for so many years. But John is being playful in that song too. You know, he's kind of saying, be careful what you're revolting against, because the next guy might be worse. Or as Pete Townsend said, meet the new boss the same as the old boss. But in the same flip side that everybody says is raucous and it's the other side of Paul. Paul's being all nice and comforting. Here comes John. No. He's saying it's going to be all right. All right. It's going to be all right. Same thing. And he's repeating it too, the way Paul is repeating a lot of phrases later on in the Na-Na part. So I think it's so great that they teamed up even when they didn't team up.
Let's hear the part of Hey Jude where he talks about you're waiting for someone to perform with, and it goes to the line, the movement you need is on your shoulder. So I want to talk to you about that line.
So let it out and let it in. Hey Jude, begin. You're waiting for someone to perform with. And don't you know that it's just you? Hey Jude, you do. The movement you need is on your shoulder.
Can you tell me about the line, the movement you need is on your shoulder, and the role that John played in keeping that in the song?
We discussed this line, myself and all the different professors and songwriters and scholars and authors and Beatle experts, three different times. And the three conclusions we came to was, number one, Paul just used it as a placeholder. The movement you need is on my on your shoulder. It means everything and it means nothing. So it's kind of playful and fun. And he told John it's a placeholder. And of course, John, being John, said it's the best line in it. It's staying in there. And to this day, Paul says he still thinks of John when he plays it. And that's why when my good friend Roberto Tatis did the cover and we got this great photograph of Paul playing it probably about 10 or 12 years ago, I imagine him playing it with his eyes closed. He's thinking of John when he plays that, when he sings that line. The second thing that came up a lot is what you talked about, the tumult of the times. Everything was about movements in 1968, the leftist movement, the women's movement, the gay movement, the civil rights movement, and it was moving into very violent and very confrontational times. There were all different movements. And as I said, I've said many times, John had the proclivity to make the grandiose statements. And thank goodness he did. You know, give peace a chance and imagine, and all you need is love. But Paul in this song is saying, no, it's right inside you. You don't need a lot of platitudes here. You don't need a big group or philosophy or religion. You need yourself to believe in yourself, and you're good enough. Hey Jude, you'll do. So the movement you need is on your shoulders. I think it was Adam Duritz, my friend and co-host, podcast partner, and singer and for Counting Crows, a wonderful songwriter, who said, the movement you need is on your shoulder. Of course, your head's on your shoulder. And that's where you think and you reason and you have intellectual curiosity, so it's there. And then finally, the movement you need is on your shoulder is, again, a way for Paul to leave things open for us to have some fun and people like myself or listeners to just think, what does it mean to me? Where is my personal expression of this? And this is why I said earlier, you know, what an incredible balancing act great artists do when they take the universal and the personal and they put it together to be something great like this. And that line, I think, encapsulates all of that. As, if I may, one last thing, Emily, about that. I really do believe that Hey Jude is the culmination of all the things that the Beatles and Paul McCartney do well. I think you have the full history, scope, and density of what the Beatles meant to their generation and their musical, as we heard, you know, we were talking about earlier, their musical influences and tastes, and just their complete influence on the zeitgeist, I think is right there in this song, which is one of the reasons why I picked it, but it became ever more evident as I dove deeper into it.
And you capture, I think, the bittersweet nature of listening to this song, knowing what was to come in terms of the Beatles not staying together much longer, in terms of the later assassination of John Lennon, other assassinations, other things that were going to happen. Can you talk about that, that listening to this song now makes you aware of what was about to happen to the Beatles as a group?
This was pointed out by Devin McKinney, who wrote one of my favorite Beatle books, Magic Circles. He said, remember, this is the last time all four Beatles walked into a studio and recorded a single song for a single, for a standalone single. And even though the Beatles changed the entire paradigm of popular music by making an album a real artistic statement, which it ended up being in the late 60s, 70s, 80s, and today, they were a singles band at heart. You know, Love Me Do, I Want to Hold Your Hand, She Loves You, Paperback Writer, Hey Jude, you know. Because after this, they would record The Ballad of John and Yoko, but that's just Paul and John playing that together. So George and Ringo weren't there for that session. And the rest of the singles for the remaining year and a half of their career, Let It Be, Come Together, were from albums, something. So this is it. These are the Beatles, one last time, going in to make a song. Not a huge, giant album like the White Album, which they were working on at the time in May and June and July of 1968. But just 1-2 days of the four of them getting in a room. No orchestras, no backwards tracks. There's an orchestra on it later, but it was laid in. And just play the song. And that's why when they're playing that thing on the way out, it's like, who's going to stop the Beatles? Let them play it for 4 minutes. They're having a blast. And Paul reiterates that. We just had so damn much fun doing this. And they're just joyous. And I kind of feel it's the last final sunshiny yawp of Beatlemania. It's their final tip of the hat. It's them saying, yeah, we're the Beatles. Let's all sing together. Let's do this one last time because there's some cold winds a-coming.
And I guess one other question I have about this song and the place it holds in the Beatles is more on the practical side. You have a chapter of your book, I think you call it Factoids. But, you know, they are a huge money-making group. They are experimenting with new technologies like the 8-track. They are doing movie versions. They're doing all these other things, too. How does Hey Jude fit with sort of the enterprise of the Beatles?
Yeah, you mentioned it. It's the first record they ever recorded on 8-tracks instead of the 4 they had been working on for years at EMI, or more famously known as Abbey Road. And then they went to Trident Studios, which was brand new, so they sort of kicked them off. And I love this little tidbit that the same piano that Paul plays on Hey Jude, Freddie Mercury plays on Bohemian Rhapsody. Elton John plays on Leave On. Rick Wakeman plays on the brilliant David Bowie Life on Mars. I mean, that's so cool, right? You know, and so yeah, you got that. Then you have you mentioned it. I interviewed the great Michael Lindsay Hogg for the book. Michael, who directed all that footage and was sort of a star in the Get Back series by Peter Jackson this past fall on Disney Plus, and would eventually become Let It Be. But what Michael did so well in the late 60s was provide these little films, these promotional films, so they can reach more people without touring. And of course, that became the music video, which launched MTV and all the other stuff. But the film itself is, and I dedicate a whole chapter to it. Thanks for bringing it up, because it's so powerful. When it was played on the David Frost show and then later on the Smothers Brothers show in the fall of 68, I think days after the Democratic Convention with all the riots, the whole world is watching police beating kids up. And, you know, it just means something to see these four guys again in a room. And then the whole world kind of stumbling in, all these kids of different ages and older people, and a guy wearing a turban, and African-American, and an English black man, and a Jamaican, and a young woman, an older woman, all singing the na-nas. The Beatles are reasserting themselves as this powerful orb, sort of this place where love comes in, you know? And they're allowing that to happen in a visual sense because they're a visual band. And that matters to the Beatles. And I think it matters, I think, in the great history of this song. Yeah.
I think you mentioned in the book that there are somebody counted, and there are 216 na-na's in the song. We are going to talk about the ending of this famous song and also some of the covers that other groups have done to Hey Jude when we continue in a moment on University of the Air.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it
Imaginary Futures cover of Hey Jude. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with James Campion, and we are talking about the amazing Beatles song Hey Jude. James, this is one of the covers that you mentioned enjoying. It certainly returns it to a kind of lullaby-like feel.
Yeah, that's Jesse Epstein. It goes by Imaginary Future. I was so moved by that that I contacted Jesse, and he actually commented in the book. And now that I listen back to it, it's got a little emotional currency for me, because what he says in the book, and I'm paraphrasing, you know, I think of Paul comforting John's child, and I hope to have a child someday, and I hope to sing this to them when they fall asleep. And it's then, of course, I'm thinking of me singing it to myself when I'm trying to get myself to fall asleep, and it all kind of comes together, coalesces into this feeling that you get. And it really is a gorgeous cover. I love that. I love his voice, and he really does mean it. And I went through dozens and dozens and dozens of interpretations of this song and got all different takes on it. And I'm so glad I did, because it just showed me the elasticity, the bones, the incredible structure and foundation of this thing. And it made me respect Paul even more, as not only as an artist, but as a craftsman. And I know I said that a couple of times in this interview, but he's just damn good at his craft, you know?
He definitely is. He says in that Stephen Colbert clip, after going through various different influences that he had had and other things, he then quips, and I'm a genius, which is certainly true at times.
It's so true.
Yeah, so with other covers that you ran into of Hey Jude, were there others that stood out?
Yeah, the one that's lauded, and I, of course, had to mention, was Wilson Pickett's, for a couple of reasons. Number one, Wilson Pickett is one of the great vocalists of all time, period. Number two, it came out just a few months after Hey Jude just left the charts. I mean, Hey Jude was number one in America for 9 weeks. It's the longest run of any Beatles song at number one in America, which shocked me when I started. That was one of those, what the what? So I wanted to know about that. And of course, many of the professors of sociology and psychology, everything chimed in on that little bauble. But it's very important to note that the incredible influence of a song that's just dominating, and then someone has the guts. Can you imagine today if a huge song came out and it was out for weeks and months, and then you recorded it? And then a lot of people note that they feel that that's a superior version than the Beatles version. I don't, but it's spectacular. And the final thing I'll say about Wilson Pickett's great version of this is that Duane Allman, who would start the Allman Brothers, was the Muscle Shoals guitar player in that wonderful Muscle Shoals studio band. That is the most gospel version. If you listen to Wilson Pickett sing this song, it's got such a southern sort of real... it's kind of what Paul was going for, I think. But he's an Englishman, he's Caucasian, and now it's going back, you know? It's going back to the roots of the music, to the actual place where it can lie comfortably. And I think that's why a lot of critics... sing the praises of Wilson Pickett's cover, because it does, in many ways, if it doesn't improve upon it, it certainly shines a great and important light on it.
Let's hear a little of the Wilson Pickett cover of Hey Jude.
Anytime you feel the pain, Hey Jude, refrain. Don't carry the world upon your shoulder. Some fool who plays it cool by making the world a little bit colder.
down. You found her. Now go on out and get her. But remember to let her in your heart. Then you can start to make it better.
It's interesting to hear that because you can see how Wilson Pickett takes the song, makes it not necessarily better, but different. And maybe that whole idea of taking a sad song and making it better, it's like an invitation to call and response. We take what we're given in the world. We take what's there, and then we try to transform it. It's interesting how every time I hear the words now, I hear something else.
Yeah. Man, that is something else. You got that right. I don't know. I got nothing else to add to that. But it's kind of what you guys do, Emily, with the Odyssey. And, you know, it's just the whole pay it forward concept is in Hey Jude. And the fact that Paul enacts the gospel phrasing in this song, especially the ending, but even in those bridges, and what Wilson Pickett does there, and how he's scatting within the melody the way you would if you were a gospel singer or you came from a gospel tradition like Sam Cooke or Aretha Franklin, and how, oh, that just must have tickled Paul Pink, because that matters. And he does make this a lot more, I can't even think of the word, is it visceral? Let's go with mm-hmm. that, you know?
Even subversive, because when you hear the Hey Jude yeah. song, it can, in some ways, when the Beatles sing it, it can sound like an escape,
yes.
like an escape from the times. But then in the hands of Wilson Pickett, it becomes much more subversive and much more kind of here we are dealing with this.
Yes.
Did you find, as you worked on this book, Take a Sad Song, The Emotional Currency of Hey Jude, during a pandemic, that the times you were in as you wrote the book played a special role in how you saw it?
Yes. Yes, because there's the personal and the universal. There's the comfort and unity, which I title one of the chapters, the comfort part, the Hey Jude part, the structural ballad part, and then the coda, which is the unity. We're all singing together. And what more time in any of our lifetimes, because this is a once in a hundred year thing, so there's not a lot of people who are around the first time this happened, and they were really young. What more discomfort and disunity was there? It was stark. And yes, on a personal level, once again, Hey Jude got me through a dark night. This one was a bunch of months of us being stuck in here and scared for our parents, scared for our friends. My good friend Adam Schlesinger from Fountains of Wayne, another brilliant songwriter, lost his life during the pandemic, and it was real. And we're getting out of it now. We still have hints of it. People are still getting it, but you know, you remember how the hospitals were packed and people were dying, and people kept saying on the news, this is like 1968. This is craziest year since 1968. And here I was writing this book. So it was very visceral. And I want to piggyback one last thing about what you were saying, which is so true about the escape. This song works on those levels too. It's an escapist concept of like, let's listen to the song, relax for a minute. Let's exhale, let it out, let it in. But also, Rob Sheffield from Rolling Stone points this out. It is a radical statement in its length, and also the fact that I feel, my interpretation is, it's an escape in which you're escaping a cycle of bad man's inhumanity to man, or terrible things that we do over and over again and keep making excuses for and enabling. To escape is to move, to get out. So it's not just escape. It's like, you know, the Timothy Leary dropout thing. Okay, it's a way for us to move, and the movement you need, you know, there's constant movement in this song. Forward, it's a journey, as Tim Riley said, and so I think you nailed it right there. It has got two forms of escape, and they work on both of those levels.
You've talked about the ending and how long. First of all, how long the whole song is, over 7 minutes, and then the ending, where that's, you know, 4 minutes of the na-na-na stuff,
yeah,
with Paul saying it wasn't intended to go on that long, but I was having such fun ad-libbing. We're going to go out on the ending from a live performance that he did. Do you have anything you want to say about the long ending and the function of those na-na-nas before we thank you for being on and hear it as we go out.
Yeah, and I thank you for playing this version. It's from 1989. It was the show I saw, and I named the last chapter, "I Can Feel It, Can You Feel It?" And he screams that at one point, and it just gives me the chills every time. And then he says something towards the end, "I can't stop this thing. I can't stop it." And it's so sincere, and it's kind of the way the Beatles felt. And when George Martin said, "We can't put a 7-minute song on the radio, they won't take anything over 2.5. And John Lennon, it wasn't even his song, stood up and said, "They will if it's us. We're the Beatles." So the fact that they did that is just so great. And every time I hear it keep going on and on, I think is such, you know, ego and such pride and such audacity. And that's why I love this song so much. Thank you. This version is great. Emily, thank you so much for having me on. This is one of the best interviews I've ever been a part of. I love the work you guys are doing with Odyssey. And I thank once again Professor Werner for introducing us and for being in my book. And I urge everyone to enjoy the book. And I hope you get out of it what I put into it.
My guest has been James Campion, and his book, Take a Sad Song, The Emotional Currency of Hey Jude, will help you see the song in a whole new way. We are going to go out on the ending of a live performance by Paul McCartney of the famous Hey Jude. I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year for the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Don't let me down, but you have found. Yeah.